WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. Malcolm X would have been 67 years old today. He was assassinated in 1965. While Martin Luther King preached nonviolence, Malcolm X said that violence was sometimes the only language the oppressor understood. What did Malcolm X say that might help us understand the violent response to the Rodney King verdict? We called Claiborne Carson, author of the books Malcolm X, The FBI File, and In Struggle, SNCC and the Black Awakening of the 1960s. He's also the director and editor of the Martin Luther King Papers Project.
You know, Terry, one of the things that often happens with Malcolm is that the statements that are quoted most often have to do with his criticisms of nonviolence, and those are often brought forward whenever we have outbreaks of violence, like in recent days. But I think that the more enduring part of his message had to do with the development of institutions in the black community, and that part of the message is I think, vitally important today. He was calling for building up the black family, the social institutions, the religious institutions, the political institutions of the community, seeing that as the basis for any kind of gains that we might make in the future. His message is often called non-black nationalism, but I think that the most important aspects of it didn't have to really to do with the building of a new black nation, but the building of an institutional nation within American society. And so I think that would be the most important part of Malcolm's message.
Have you been thinking at all about, if Malcolm X were alive, what he might have said in response to the King verdict and the L.A. riots?
Well, obviously he would be very angered by it. By the
verdict or the riots or both?
The verdict and trying to find some way of expressing that anger that so many of us felt in a manner that was constructive, that would lead to something positive. I think that's the real test of leadership, is when you get people frustrated and they want to be mobilized, and there's got to be something there for them to do that can lead to an advancement in their lives. And I think in some ways the leadership did not come through in the recent days. And I fault myself as much as anyone else, because you have to be credible. You have to have made the connections, particularly in the black community, before the crisis comes. And there wasn't a lot of credible leadership that could have led this into a nonviolent and constructive and yet militant channel, so that rather than destroying parts of the black community, that this could have led to something that would really enhance that community.
The Watts riots were the same year as the assassination of Malcolm X. Do you see any connection between Watts and the movement as defined by Malcolm?
Well, I was there in 1965, and what I recall, first of all, was just the surprise that it happened. You know, in 1965, we just weren't prepared for it. You know, I had been a civil rights activist, and at that time, I was affiliated with a group called NVAC. I recall, you know, standing on Central Avenue, looking down the street and seeing buildings in flame, and having that sudden sense that all of that militancy that we felt we had, we thought we were the most radical and militant of all the groups, and yet suddenly we felt that all of that militancy was kind of irrelevant in the new period that was starting with Watts. And I think after that, we were always searching for answers, and Malcolm appeared to offer the answer, because he seemed to speak to that reality that we saw when parts of Los Angeles were burning down in 1965. But I think looking back, we took different parts of his message, and only over the years have we understood the full dimension of that message. I think what was easiest to take was his criticisms of nonviolence, because we were frustrated by that, by the limitations and by the way in which many white supporters of the civil rights movement used nonviolence as a criterion for whether they were going to support it at all, and kind of had this attitude that black people alone among all Americans should be restricted to the use of nonviolent tactics. We were determined to not accept that anymore. But I think that the question of violence versus nonviolence was only part of his message. And I think it took a longer time to begin to understand the other aspects of his message, the message about institutional development in the black community, the message about understanding the significance of African American history. Malcolm was one of the first great leaders, of mass leaders of the modern period, to study that history and to bring it into play in terms of his political message. So I think that over the last 27 years since his assassination, we've gradually incorporated more and more of Malcolm's message.
I want to get back to something that you were just saying, you know, that when in 1965 you were a member of a very militant group, but then during the Watts riots you started thinking this kind of militancy had become irrelevant. What made you feel that, irrelevant?
Well, you know, we had tried to organize people in the South Central L.A. during the years before the rebellion broke out, and it was hard going. It was hard to convince people, and we said that, you know, our form of nonviolence is not the same as King's. We were much more aggressive. We were much more determined to go up against the establishment. But when you saw the outpouring of popular support for what went on in August of 1965, the people out in the streets, all smiling, all participating in it, even the ones, a lot of them were not looting or participating in arson or anything like that, but they were clearly pleased by the fact that they had taken over the community and basically kicked the police out. And what became clear is that spontaneous event had mobilized black people to an extent that we had never succeeded in doing. And that's what made it seem like, you know, our approach, our strategy was just insufficient to meet the needs and the frustrations that people felt at that time.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Claiborne Carson, author of Malcolm X, The FBI File, and he's also the editor of the Martin Luther King Papers Project. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Today is the birth date of Malcolm X, and I'm speaking with Claiborne Carson, who, among other things, has written the book Malcolm X, The FBI File. Malcolm X remains a very popular figure and a very important figure, and on the most superficial level, you could see that importance reflected in the number of Malcolm X posters and Malcolm X hats around. Is there anything else you would like to have us think about on this date, which is the birth date of Malcolm X?
Well, I think the enduring part of Malcolm's message and the significance of his life have to do with the fact that he was a person who came out of the worst aspects of the black experience in America. When you compare him to King, King had a lot of the privileges of being brought up in a middle-class environment, in which he had a lot of advantages. Malcolm didn't have those advantages. His life exposed him not to the American dream, but the American nightmare. He was a person who kind of started at the bottom. He was at the bottom of his life, indeed, when he was in prison and when he discovered the message of the Nation of Islam. And I think that when we see how he pulled his life together and began to understand the intelligence and the creativity and the energy and the drive that he had, and began to put it to use, not to get himself rich or to move ahead as an individual, but to help his people get ahead. I think that is an inspiring message, and it's one that has particular significance for us today because there is a part of the black community that has not benefited from the gains of the 1960s, that is still at the bottom of the American social order, that has very little hope. And when people in that group look to Malcolm and look at his life, they can see something that represents a possibility for themselves, much more than, say, looking to King or looking to the nationally visible black leadership. He is somebody who comes out of the experience that many black people share, and it's the being exposed to the vicious aspects of American society and yet being able to prevail over that.
You know, what you're saying reminds me of something that I know I was thinking, I'm sure a lot of people were thinking, watching Ted Koppel's interviews with some of the gang leaders in Los Angeles. You couldn't help but think about how smart some of them were and what really good leaders they'd make they're already good leaders, but they're leaders in this kind of underground, you know, they're leaders of gangs. But you wonder if they had more options open to them and if they weren't forced into this kind of underground.
That's the tragedy of American life. I mean, we have allowed over the last 20-some years, we've lost a generation of people whose talents have been thrown into the gutter because they've been given poor schools. The health care in the black community has been allowed to deteriorate. Drugs have been allowed to come into the community and destroy all of that potential that is there. And I think that's what we have to begin to reverse, is that we can't throw away the potential of a significant part of this society and still think that the society is not going to suffer for that. We are, as a nation, need to take responsibility for this. And I think that the notion that somehow there are these talented individuals who are appearing on TV now that they've drawn attention to themselves, but they'll disappear very quickly, and they'll just go back to being obscure individuals, unless the society as a whole understands that's a talent, that's that kind of energy that can go into keeping a drug-related organization alive for over a decade that involves many hundreds and perhaps thousands of individuals, that's a talent that needs to be tapped for more constructive purposes. And I think that if we can do that as a society, the society as a whole will be stronger. If we don't do it, the entire society is going to go down the drain.
You know, this reminds me of something else that Malcolm X said about the chickens coming home to roost. I mean, I think really one of the lessons of the LA riots is that when there's a lot of poverty and despair in a culture, it affects everybody. You know, you're not going to be free of it, even if you're middle class or if you're affluent. It's going to come back and affect you.
Well, I think that part of the problem has been that there is this very strong, widely shared illusion that you can create an island of affluence that separates you from the problems of the inner city. And many Americans still believe that they can get their house in the suburbs, that they can not pay taxes to build up the inner cities, that they can forget about the problems of the public schools, that those don't matter for them because they've got theirs and the rest of the society can go to hell. You know, I think that this kind of an assumption, this kind of an attitude, has been at the root of what's brought us to this point where we are two societies, one affluent and one poor, and the gulf between them is getting larger and larger. So I think that that's something that you know, when Malcolm was talking about the chickens coming home to roost, you know, I think there is that sense that someday they will. The question is whether that will take so long that when they do come home to roost, it will be an explosion of violence that will dwarf anything that we've had before. I think that there is a real danger in this country that we're so out of touch with the realities that are facing poor people in the inner cities, that we really assume that people are going to accept that forever, that they will allow their lives to be destroyed without fighting back. And that's never happened with any people in the world, and I don't think it's going to happen with the people in the inner cities. And I think that, if anything, the violence in L.A. is a warning signal. We talked once in this country about the fire bell in the night that was the warning that the Civil War was coming. And I think that we're getting the same kinds of warning signals, that we cannot continue to allow this society to be as divided as it is over issues of economics and class without paying the price ultimately.
Claiborne Carson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Claiborne Carson is a professor of history at Stanford University and the author of Malcolm X, The FBI File. He's also the editor of the Martin Luther King Papers Project. This is Fresh Air.